The testing's right. If there are any extras, we just make sure that either extra 3x5 cards or extra handouts come back up to the front. Okay. Let me start with just a couple of announcements. For those of you taking the lab, the first lab meeting is still not yet this week. It'll be next week. It's a Valentine's Day special. You lost me? Hello? No? It says it's on here. Yeah? Test? Okay. Pardon me. Okay. You let me know before I get into something substantive if you can't hear me. So that will be a week from Thursday. Electricity test is 2 weeks from tonight, so we'll devote about the first hour of the class to the electricity test. Not that I think it will take that long for everybody, but that way you'll know what to plan. So if you finish early, you can go out and grab a coffee or something and come on back, and then we'll resume at 4 with the lecture next week. All right, in 2 weeks. Okay. Also, I wanted to mention that if you're looking for the lecture notes or the podcast, you can go to my website and go to the courses that I teach, and there's Psychophysiology for 2008, and on down here you'll see there's a link to podcasts and slides. And I removed the video podcast link that isn't working because the video podcast will be delayed by about a week. We'll get that worked out. The color slides are always there, and if you want to bring a laptop into class, there's wireless if you want to see the thing in color or do anything, you're welcome to do that because you can grab them right as we're doing it as well. I'm talking, it's on. No?
Oh, wait.
Now we good?
No. It's on.
It's on? The big green light.
So we have new batteries and
test. It worked briefly and then it didn't work?
Yeah, I heard you perfectly.
Can you play it
over?
Yeah. Test. Test.
Okay. So we're gonna have to hear you. We're gonna have to record you. Oh.
You're working.
Buzzing. But I'm not,
you know. Okay.
It's an awful sound quality.
Really? Makes me wonder about the quality of this wire.
Yeah, maybe.
Still buzzing?
Really badly. Do you want to come here?
No, I'll take your word for it.
So let's undo the radio mics and go with the...
That one? Okay. Then does it still pick me up okay?
I don't know. We never tested that.
All right. Well, let's see what happens.
You know what I can do is I can move this up to that socket and it'll be closer to you?
Sure. Let's do that. Okay. All right. So, let's start then. Yes.
The page of the podcast and whatnot, is that still Firefox only?
The little utility that gets you past the front end to get to the readings. Oddly enough, that was produced, I made that in a Microsoft product, but it won't work with a Microsoft product, so it only works with Firefox. I think it works with Safari. I think it works with Opera. Does it work on yours? Okay. You're using IE6 or IE7?
I don't know. Whatever comes with a brand new computer.
Maybe IE7. I don't know. But I encountered it. I tried it on several computers, and I can't figure out quite why. It's trying to install some kind of ActiveX control, which I didn't put in there. And it's not in any of the code that I can see. It has something to do with the way IE7 runs the script. Okay. If you want to email me, I can just give you the link directly as well, and then you can just bookmark that and go straight there. You don't have to go through that little interface. All that interface does is if you give it the right password, it sends you to the right link. Is anybody else having trouble getting the readings? Okay. All right. So I mentioned that each time we'll start with a little bit of a discussion of things that came up on the 3x5 cards, and I won't go through everybody's 3x5 card or we'd take a very long time. There were a lot of good questions last time, and if yours isn't here, don't worry, yours will be eventually. And some of the questions were things that we're going to cover next, a little bit later, lecture, two lectures, four lectures, so I didn't necessarily cover those just yet. But this turned out to be a frequently asked question, And this was, can you elaborate on the difference between correlate and substrate? What do these words mean in everyday language? Which I thought was a good way to think about it. So when we look at a psychophysiological measure, it's tempting to think that we're measuring something that really is fundamental and causal to the psychological effect of interest. That is, if it's a substrate, then it is in some way causing the behavior. Whereas a correlate is just what we mean in everyday language. It's correlated. It goes along with, but it doesn't necessarily imply anything causal. So I was trying to think of an everyday example with today's weather in mind. Rain is a substrate, one of the substrates of puddles. Okay? There are other substrates of puddles. There is bad drainage, for example. That would also be a substrate of puddles. On the other hand, umbrellas are a correlate of puddles. They are in no way causal to puddles. Puddles are in no way causal to umbrellas, but they are correlated because there's some third variable which might be causal to both. Okay. So that might be an everyday way to think about it. So when we see something like brain activity, whether it be brain electrical activity or a hemodynamic response that shows us a particular region of the brain that's active in a task, it's very tempting to think that this is somehow causally related because the brain causes behavior. Most people would agree. But it doesn't mean that that specific region and the activity in that region is what's causing the specific behavior we're interested in. Right? It could be a correlate of something else that we also see in our image or something that we're not able to detect in our image. So just because it's coming from the brain doesn't mean it's a substrate. It just means that it's a correlate and you're going to have to look further.
What's a substrate again?
Substrate is a physiological cause of a psychological phenomenon. Okay. All right. Now we talked quite a bit about making inferences given that we have physiological measures and psychological measures. And one question I thought was good was, why are multiple physiological sources to one psychological phenomenon a problem? Or in the vernacular that we used last time, why are multiple multiple phi to one psi a problem? Can we not theorize that a combination of phi underlie the psi? In other words, a combination of different physiological events underlie that psychological event. Maybe jointly they would be some kind of a substrate even. Well, if we go back to this picture that I showed last time, there were different kinds of relationships. Ideally, everybody wants a one-to-one relationship, right? One physiological system to one psychological phenomenon. That helps the inference problem, because then when you see the psychological phenomenon and you see the physiological response, and when you see that physiological response, you can infer the presence of the psychological phenomenon. But the reason that it's a problem when you have two physiological responses for one is that the presence of just one would not necessarily be sufficient to make an inference that the psychological phenomenon occurs. Okay? But the person who asked the question, I'm sorry, that typo didn't come in the person's question, I got that in there myself. The question is a good one. We can indeed say that, well, if we see a pattern of physiological responses, then those may be uniquely associated with some psychological event or some psychological state, and then we've reduced it to a one-to-one relationship, which was the purpose of this diagram here, showing how you can go from these complicated relationships, if you're willing to make a few assumptions, that combinations of physiological responses, or even combinations of physiological responses over time, might then become a unique physiological signature that correlates with the psychological state. Okay? This still doesn't address the substrate correlate issue directly, right? Because it still could just be a physiological correlate or a pattern of physiology that correlates. Okay. There were a couple of questions that came out of the illustrations I gave using brain-computer interface about the patients with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. One of them, an ethical question, how do you get ALS patients' consent for research participation? Many times these studies begin before the person is entirely locked in. And in fact, Neil Birbaumer's work shows that if you wait until they're entirely locked in, you might not be successful. So if they have some ability to respond initially, they might be able to provide some yes or no consent initially. Now, if they weren't, then I guess it would have to fall to their power of attorney for making these decisions, which would usually be a spouse or a parent or a sibling in those cases. And another question related to that, does the system Stephen Hawking uses to speak rely at all on biofeedback? Because he also has ALS and has for many years. So I went to his own website, and he says, a computer expert in California called Walt Woltaus heard of my plight, and he sent me a computer program he'd written called Equalizer. A cursor moves across the screen, and I can stop it by pressing a switch in my hand. The switch is my only interface with the computer. This way I can select words which are printed on the lower part of the screen. When I built up a sentence, I can send it to the speech synthesizer. And he, in another part of the website, he said he can get about 15 words a minute using this system. But it's not entirely locked in, so he doesn't have much movement, but he still is able to press the switch reliably. So it's similar to those systems, except that he's actually controlling a switch instead of doing something with brain activity. Okay. And the final 3x5 for today, what's the difference between EEGs and ERPs in the way that they're recorded? If this isn't a question that would even occur to you, don't worry, we'll come to it later. But recording, they're very similar and often identical. We record the ongoing EEG, and the ERP is embedded within it. So the recording really doesn't differ. We may have some subtle differences in terms of the frequencies that we're interested in, so how we filter the signal, and we'll come to that later. But for all intents and purposes now, they're recorded identically. It's how they're processed that's different. Okay. If we're interested in frequency domain characteristics of the EEG, we would process those data differently than if we're interested in time domain event-related potentials. Okay. All right. So today we're going to cover some foundations. Some of this may be review for many people. Some of it may be new, just depending what kind of academic pedigree you come with. And the reason we'll be covering these foundations is because we're looking at bioelectrical signals. And so we'll be covering the basic electrical part and the basic bio part of this. So bioelectrical, but we'll be doing it in electrical bio order. So part one of this will cover basic electricity. I'll talk a little bit about a few units that we need to understand by prelude. We'll talk about a little bit of atomic structure and how that relates to electricity. We'll talk about many of the great big terms in electricity, voltage, resistance, current, power, and energy. And we'll look at a couple of different kinds of circuits, hoping that you'll feel a little bit comfortable understanding what goes on in these circuits and solving for unknowns in these circuits. All right. So to begin with, oftentimes we're dealing with scales of differences in magnitude of measurement that are very large. And so instead of having lots of zeros after a number or lots of zeros after a decimal point, scientists are going to use this kind of notation using numbers here on your left to denote things that are smaller than one and numbers here that are much greater than one. And so, for example, a centimeter is a hundredth of a meter, and a millimeter is a thousandth of a meter, and a micrometer is a millionth of a meter, and a nano is a trillionth of an iPod. So you can just see how the scale goes. The iPod Pico, we don't care what color it's in because you're not going to be able to see it anywhere. On the other end of the spectrum, we have things like kilo, which is a thousand. So a kilogram is a thousand grams. If you're in Europe, you're buying your groceries in kilos, for example. Mega is a million. So megahertz, FM radio, like 91.3 megahertz, it's an oscillation, it's a frequency. AM radio is in the kilohertz range, and FM radio in the megahertz range. Gigahertz is the speed of many of our computers. When I first started computing, I worked at 8 megahertz. Now we all work at about 2 to 3 gigahertz, just as an example. And tera, now we finally crossed the terabyte boundary in terms of size. So if you actually started looking at all these zeros, you wouldn't be able to quickly comprehend the magnitude of the number, and that's kind of a problem. So we use these, you know, easy conventions instead. Now, if you're really kind of a geek, there's a slight difference here in terms of how bytes and kilobytes and megabytes and gigabytes and terabytes go. They're not strictly in base 10, but they're the binary equivalent. So 2 to the 10th is 1024. So this is just 1024 times 1024 times 1024. So each of these goes up by a magnitude of 1,000. But when you're dealing with storage, for example, they're going up by a magnitude of 1,024. So a kilobyte is 1,024 bytes, and then a megabyte is 1,024 kilobytes, and so on. So if you've ever wondered why you buy an 80 gig drive and you format it and it comes out looking like less than that, that's because it's actually, you're dividing by 1024. It's less than that. Okay. So if you see these numbers, then that'll be familiar. Now, we use them scientifically, but I also think there are other places we could use them. So this is some delightful news from today's Wall Street Journal about our federal budget deficit. It's going to soar to $3.1 trillion this year, our budget request, and our budget deficit, $410 billion. But it wouldn't really sound quite so bad if it were just a $3.1 teradollar budget and we just have a $410 gigadollar deficit. Okay. Now, moving into electricity, there are electrical forces in nature, and they fit within the entire scheme of great forces. And so there are three of them: nuclear, often mispronounced nuclear, electrostatic, and gravitational. So nuclear forces are operating at very short subatomic distances. They're extremely strong. They're nothing you want to mess around with at home, or they could be kind of disastrous. Electrostatic charges are the ones we're interested in, and these hold all kinds of stuff together in the everyday world. Okay? And these are the kinds of things we'll talk about when we talk about basic electricity. And then we're not really going to be interested in gravitational charges. These are the weakest, but they work over very, very long, large distances when you have very, very large masses like suns and stars and things like that. So we're going to kind of ignore both of those on either side and focus on the electrostatic charges here. So to understand electrostatic charges, we have to go back to the structure of the atom. And these can occur because of the charged nature of the subatomic particles. So within any atom, you're going to find a proton and an electron and potentially some neutrons. And two of these three are charged. The proton has a positive charge and the electron has a negative charge. And the neutron is just like a government bureaucrat. It doesn't have any charge and it just sits there and has mass. Now, there are two basic principles that make this whole thing operate, and that is that unlike charges attract and like charges repel. So you've got this orbiting electron, and by the way, the electron weighs only 1/14,000th as much as the proton, so it's this lightweight, negatively charged thing that goes roaring around the center of the atom. And because unlike charges attract, it kind of keeps it in orbit. There's an attraction between the proton and the electron. Keeps that electron in orbit. But what gets interesting for electricity is those electrons can sometimes get out of orbit and they, are promiscuous and go other places. And that's electricity. Now, like charges are going to repel. You get two positives together, they'll push away. Two negatives together, they will push away. Oh, the other thing I guess to say about this is, all matter has this kind of structure. So even matter we think of as solid isn't truly solid in that there is lots of space in between there and movement going on. But when the forces are strong enough, you can appreciate how strong those forces are. Now, electrons can be freed, okay, and free electrons is not a political statement, but it's just the fact that electrons can be displaced and moved out of their orbit. And so you might have done an experiment something like this when you were in high school physics or chemistry class, where you demonstrate the transfer of electrons from one substance to another. So in this, there's a hard rubber rod that I think they only sell to science teachers, and fur, and you rub those things together and you can transfer electrons. So I'm not a high school science teacher, so I had to come up with something else. But I have balloons and I have a sweater. So we'll see if we can demonstrate some electrical principles right here before your very eyes. I have a couple of balloons, and although they may have a little bit of charge, but they shouldn't have very much. Certainly they don't have enough charge to stick. If I hold them next to each other, there's no power of repulsion between them. So if I take and give a good rub, and now they don't. Well, think I'm turned quite right. They're trying to repel each other. You can see they're kind of pushing. That's fine. Okay. All right. Try it yourself if you like. See how charged you are. Okay. So what happened there? Right, like charges repelled, so both the balloons acquired the same charge. And where did that charge come from? My shirt, right. So electrons jumped. Electrons transferred from my shirt to the balloon, and the balloon thus acquired a negative charge. Okay? And it stuck to my shirt because there was a net loss of electrons from the shirt and that gain of electrons to the balloons. And then it sticks because unlike charges attract. And when I took the two balloons and they pushed each other apart, you can see unlike charges repel. Okay. Up there, the demo. Okay. All right. So let's start then by talking about static electricity. This is just what we demonstrated here. Oftentimes you can get this when there is friction between relatively poor conductors. You wouldn't think of the balloon as a good conductor. It's not going to conduct electricity very easily. Right? If I put a battery on one side, I won't be able to make a light bulb go off on the other side. It's not a good conductor. But it can still accumulate charge. If you've walked across a carpet, you may accumulate charge from the carpet, and then you go to something like a metal light switch to touch it, and you feel you discharge that electric charge that you've accumulated. That's just also a case of static electricity. It leads to a voltage potential difference. So when we talk about voltage, we're really talking about a difference in electrical potential between two different spaces, two different items. Okay? If there's no voltage difference, then there's no voltage potential. So maybe a very good example of this is you look at those very high voltage lines. They've got danger written all over them. And you look at a bird, and it sits on one, and it doesn't become dinner. Right? It just is fine. But that's because one foot and the other foot are on the wire, and there's no voltage difference along that wire. But if the bird were big enough or the wires were close enough and it could touch one of the other wires where there might be a voltage difference, then it would be quite a calamity. Right? And the bird would be fried instantly because there would be a voltage potential difference that could travel through the bird and be cooked. So where there's a voltage potential difference, then you have the potential for electrical work to be done. Now, if you don't like electricity or you don't come to it easily, you can think of electricity by way of analogy, and that is as water. And there are three variables that we'd be interested in determining how water could flow, one of which is how much water is stored up and under kind of how much pressure is it. So as there's more and more in this tank, there's more water that can flow out and potentially at a higher rate. So this is roughly equivalent to what we're going to be calling voltage. It's the potential to do work. Right here, it's stored energy. Here, we have a small pipe, garden hose or something in this example, and that provides some resistance, so not all of the water can come out at one time. And then flowing out the other end is the current, or the rate of flow of the water. So intuitively, if you looked at this kind of equation, if you wanted more flow, you would have either a larger hose that provides less resistance, or you'd have a greater source of energy, a larger tank with perhaps a higher drop due to gravity that could potentially put the water out faster. So these are going to be related mathematically in electricity as well. So we have this, that here, the water is the equivalent of the electrical potential or the voltage. The hose is the equivalent of resistance with the diameter, larger diameter being less resistance and smaller diameter being more resistance. And the water coming out the other end is the equivalent of current or the flow. Now, if we look at like a basic circuit here, we might have some kind of source of energy or power up here, which would be the a battery, for example. And electrons are going to flow from the more negative towards the more positive, because electrons are negatively charged, so they'll be drawn towards a more positive charge. And as they flow, they can power something like a light bulb here. Now, as electrons would flow this direction towards the more positive, in their wake they would leave more positivity where they left, and where they flow towards would become more negative. And current is talked about kind of in the opposite. It flows from the other direction, from positive to negative. You've got electrons going one direction, leaving positive in their wake, but then it goes the other direction. And I mentioned that this is just for direct current, things like batteries. In a little bit, we'll talk about alternating current, like the kind that comes out of the wall, where the direction of current is changing rapidly, many times per second. So there are lots of different terms that are used in this, in basic electricity. We've talked about a couple of them already. So E, for electromotive force, is the voltage, with larger voltage differences translating to a greater potential to do work. And the unit that we measure this in is simply volts. Okay? So typical batteries are 1.5 volts. The little battery that I took out of this microphone that didn't work was a 9 volt. The wall power is 110 volts. Okay? Current is symbolized as I, and that is the rate of flow of the energy. And that's measured in amperes. So the circuit breakers in your house are rated for a certain amount of amperage. So if you have a 15 amp fuse, that might be fine for many things, but if you're plugging in your microwave and a space heater and a blow dryer, you're going to pull far too much current for that, and it would trip the circuit breaker. Resistance, R for resistance, is simply the amount of resistance to that flow of current, and it's symbolized by the Greek omega for ohm. And then things we'll be concerned a little less with here are power and energy. Power is the rate of work, okay, and that's what you're actually charged for by the power company. The rate at which work is done is in watts. You're actually charged for energy because it's in watt hours. But if you use a lot of power at any one time, over the course of the month, you'll have a lot of kilowatt hours that you're charged for. And then finally, W for energy, which is in watt seconds or kilowatt hours, usually in the case of a household. All right. So going back to this analogy then, you can describe the relationship between current and voltage and resistance using Ohm's law. And it's a very simple set of equations that are just linear transformations of each other. And so the voltage is going to equal the current times the resistance. And that's usually the starting place for Ohm's law, and then these are the transformations of it, where the current is the voltage divided by the resistance, and the resistance is the voltage divided by the current. If you really like Ohm's law, you can go to this little calculator here, and you can calculate any, you know, given any two variables, it'll calculate the third. It's not rocket science, but it's kind of fun. Okay. Now, if you're having trouble remembering that, there's this diagram here that can help you always, you know, figure out the third. So, E is going to equal IR. I is going to equal E over R. R is going to equal E over I. You know. Sure. So we go back to this. E will equal what's left, IR. I will equal what's left, E over R. R will equal what's left, E over I. If you look at it that way, you can always remember it. Okay. So this is what it looked like with, of course, the water analogy. Now, this is what it would look like in terms of a basic circuit. So what's been replaced, the water tank has been replaced with a symbol for an electrical source, often a battery. And it's just these series of longer and shorter bars like that. There's a resistor in the circuit that provides some resistance to the current flow, and that's symbolized by a squiggly line like that. And then the current will flow through the circuit. So if we knew what the source voltage was, and we knew what the resistance was, we could calculate the current through the circuit. Let's see. So the electrons are going to go this way, so the current is going to go this way. Right. So it's a historical accident on how this happened, but so imagine you have some electrons moving from this space to this space. Okay? So the net flow of electrons is this way. You'd think we would call that current, but instead the charge itself is changing in the other direction, right? So as the negative, as a bunch of electrons make a mass migration this way, what's left is greater positivity here. So if you were measuring voltage along every step of the way, you would see increasingly positive voltage as you went along the way. Right? So it would appear that current is flowing this way, even though the electrons are flowing this way. And I think initially, before this was understood that this was due to electrons, the scientists called it something like electrical fluid, staying with that analogy, and they had electrical fluid then flowing from positive to negative, even though the electrons themselves flow from negative to positive.
Mm-hmm. In the book notes that we're supposed to be going through, they say that they're not going to differentiate between those,
right,
and that current flow can be considered completely exactly the same as electron flow. And so
yeah,
they have you like draw the arrows, they have you draw it with
they
electron
have it,
flow.
Okay.
They call it current.
Yeah, and I think that is easier, and it really isn't going to matter for solving any of the circuits
okay.
that we have. Okay. So I wouldn't worry about that necessarily. It's
okay.
a small difference, and yeah, I think it is easier to think about if electrons always flow towards positive, and you want to think of current flow that way. It wouldn't change how you solve any of the problems.
Okay.
All right. So there's the E over IR diagram. It hopefully will be helpful to you. If you want to get power in the equation, somebody came up with this helpful diagram, but I didn't think it was that helpful. So it's in your notes on the web if you want. Okay, so here's a kind of classic and simple basic circuit problem, and that is we have here some battery source of 6 volts, which you could get, by the way, if you took 4 AA batteries and put them in series with each other, just one back to back to back to back. You get a 6-volt difference. So that would be like a simple battery source. And there's some kind of device that has a 3-ohm resistor. That could be a light bulb. It could be a heating element. I mean, these would be very low illumination and very low heat output, but you know, something like that. And then ground is always put into the circuit for completeness. So the question is, how much current flows through this circuit? All right. So if you, for a moment, okay, what do? Think of your equation here. Well, I want to solve for E, or I, right, current? The current is going to equal voltage over resistance. 2, that's right. We have 2 what? What's the unit? 2 amperes flowing through this circuit. Okay, that's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Okay. So before going to more complex circuits, let's just take a look. There's a device that any self-respecting psychophysiologist should have in the lab, and that's a volt ohm meter. It's also useful to have around the house for testing circuits and things. And amperes. All right. So let's see. Maybe we could do. Now, volt ohm meter, as it implies, can measure volts and can measure ohms. Okay. And if I turn it here, for example, to a little symbol omega, I don't know how well you can see that in the back, it's going to allow me to test the amount of ohms, which is a measure of resistance. Right? So if I just touch these two prongs to each other, it'll tell me how much resistance is just built into these wires themselves, which is about 0.9, 0.7, 0.8. It's a very small, it's less than 1 ohm of resistance. But just the wires themselves provide some resistance to current flow. Okay, now we said balloons are not good conductors. and it's not conducting at all. Okay, that's what that symbol means. Let's see, we can test. How about paper clips? They should provide some. Yeah, that provides about as good a flow as the thing. So you want to be careful sticking paper clips into electrical sockets, right? They don't provide much resistance. What about humans? About 1.8. What you can't see is there's a big M over here. Let's see if I can get that. Okay, see the M up here in megaohms? So I'm providing 1.7, 1.8 megaohms of resistance. I'm going to tense my toes. I went down to about 1.4 and came back up. So I decreased the resistance. This is a very cheap skin conductance machine. So, now I guess I got excited a little bit more and it dropped again. these things are very exciting, you know. What?
Why is tensing your toes?
Well, a muscle contraction or some kind of arousal is going to cause a decrease in resistance at the tips of my fingers. In other words, an increase in skin conductance. Okay. Now, we can also check volts, and there's a symbol here for kind of a squiggly volt or a straight volt. A squiggly volt would be alternating current, okay, which we're not going to concern ourselves with just now, and the straight volt would be DC current. So here we have kind of a common household battery, right? And these things are rated to be 1.5 volts. You can see perhaps right here. No, trust me, it says 1.5 volts. So we can check, is it 1.5 volts? This is a way that you can also check if your batteries are good, you know, if your things are not working. So here we go, and it's 1.58 volts. Okay. Now if I turn it around, and I put this black connector on the positive terminal, and this one on the negative terminal, it's negative 1.5 volts. Doesn't mean that it doesn't have voltage, it's got voltage. It's just showing you which end is positive, which end is negative. Okay. So that reminds me, as long as we're doing this, let's check this device. So now this one's supposed to be a 9-volt battery, is it not? 8.72, that should be within specs. So we'll see. Maybe it's down a little bit and that was what was causing the trouble. Now, the last thing here is we can also record current with this device. So over here, there's three different ranges. There's microamps. You can see the maybe you can do a little micro symbol. It looks like the Greek mu. There's milliamps. There's an MA there. And then maybe you can see it a little bit better there now. And then finally, 10 amps, which would be what you'd want to do if you were actually going to check something like wall current. Believe it or not, if I put this on 10 amps and I plug it in the appropriate connector over here for 10 amps, I can stick this right in the wall and it won't hurt me and it won't hurt it. And I can tell if a socket is live. Okay. If I don't have it on the right one, though, it'll fry the little machine. Okay, so let's see how much current flows through this device when I connect it to the battery. So we'd hope not much, otherwise this thing would really, you know, drain batteries when you test it. And it is 250 or so milliamps. Okay. So that's not a whole lot of current. 250 milliamps, 250 thousandths of an amp. Okay. All right. Final thing to note, this is kind of an interesting experiment. So, as I said, humans can conduct a signal, right? So I have I'm back up to my standard 1.8, 1.9 megaohm resistance. Now, for this demonstration, I'm going to ask all of you to participate. So what I want to do is to hand this one to you, and I want you to hold her hand, and you hold her hand, and go all the way around the room, and I need some people in the back to come up here so we can get this to come back over here. So what's going to happen?
Your brain's messed up.
Your brain's messed up? I'm not passing very much current. You'll be okay. Okay, so come on, I think we'll have just enough room here. And touch. No. And look at that. All of you together have about the same resistance I did alone. 1.5. Now, somebody in the back, break the chain. Oh, see? Okay, touch again.
But if we all tense our toes, then we'll go higher.
If you all start tensing your toes, it should drop lower. Okay, everybody tense their toes. Let's see if we can drop it. Look at that. And what we're doing is everybody's hands are getting just a little bit sweatier. In other words, we're decreasing the resistance at each of these points. All right, thank you, everyone. Okay. Okay. Now, the final thing that this is useful for is if you're in the lab checking equipment. So for those of you in the lab, this will make sense. There's a little sound level on most of these. That's a little microphone or a little like speaker there. If there's a good connection, it will beep. I don't know if you can hear that in the back. Okay. So if I'm testing a wire at one end and the other, like a network cable, I would just bring it back around. I'm worried about it. I touch it. If I hear a beep, then that's a good thing. But you can also sometimes get two wires that shouldn't be connected running next to each other that end up touching in some way and crossing, in which case you touch one wire, you touch the other wire that shouldn't be connected to it, and you hear a beep, it tells you that they're crossed as well. So, this is just a good way to test the integrity of a wire. All right. That's the voltmeter. I'll pass it around too in case you want to take a look at it. So what we did here is the equivalent of asking, what was the voltage on either side of the resistor? When I was touching it, I was the resistor. When we were all touching it together, we were all a bunch of resistors. Okay. And there'll be a voltage drop as you go across a resistor. And that's what we're able to measure, and that's what that voltohm measures. But if we knew what the resistance was, we could also calculate the voltage drop as well. So now here we have, so we calculated a very simple case of a 2 amps running through this circuit. So now we have a slightly more complicated circuit, and this is a series circuit, and it's called series because you see two resistors in line, or another way of saying that is in series with one another. And those two resistors then are going to have an additive effect on the resistance of the circuit. So the total resistance in this circuit will simply be a function of the sum of the two resistors in series. So the total resistance in this circuit then will be 1 plus 2 or 3. So now we come back to the simple question of how much current flows through the circuit. Again, we have a 6 volt source voltage, and we have a total equivalent resistance of 3 ohms. So the current running through here again would be 2 amps. That's right. There's 2 amps going through the whole circuit. Now that we know that, we should be able to compute how much voltage drop occurs across each resistor. Okay. And before you calculate, intuitively, would more voltage drop occur across a larger or smaller resistor? Larger resistor. That's right. Okay. So what equation would we use to calculate the voltage drop across a resistor? What's that? E over R?
E equals IR,
right, because we don't know E, right? We want to solve for E, so we want the form of it to let us solve for E. So it's simply current multiplied by resistance. Okay. So remember that the current is flowing through the whole circuit, and that is simply 2 amps. So E equals IR would be current, E2, times 1 ohm, times 1 is 2. So there's a 2 volt drop here. Okay. And then if we take current again, which is 2 amps, times 2 ohms here, 2 times 2 is 4, there'd be a 4 volt drop there. So if I were to put my volt ohm meter like this, I would measure a 6 volt difference. If I were to put my voltometer like this, what I just calculated tells me I should measure a two volt difference. And here I should measure a 4-volt difference. And of course, back to here now, again, I should measure a 6-volt difference. So resistors this way can help get a voltage into a range that is appropriate for a device. If you have a 9-volt battery, but your device can't handle 9 volts, you could put some resistors in series with the device, and then it would step down the voltage before it got to the device. And that's the point of this demonstration here. It comes from a web demo. It's kind of fun. So here's a very simple circuit. Oh, come on. There we go. All right. And we have here a 36-volt source with no resistance, but there's a switch. So currently it's disconnected. It's like a break in the wire. But when we connect it, that 36-volt source will be connected to this device, a light bulb, that requires 3 amps to work. Okay. So what's going to happen if I flip the switch right now? Yeah, right. It's too much. It's going to give too much current for that, right? Because right, it burns it right out. All right. So now you can put resistors in here. So there's a resistor. All right. So now, how much current would flow now? What's that?
35?
No, it wouldn't be 35. It's not subtractive, right? So we want to know. We have to assume, I guess, for the moment that this resistance is negligible, which it wouldn't be, but... So, what would the current be flowing through here? Okay, so this is 36. So E is 36.
Okay.
Yes, right? So I equals E over R. So right now we would have 36 divided by 1, or 36 amps running through the circuit. Doesn't look good for the light bulb, right? All right. So maybe instead of just empirically trying it, could we figure out what would be the amount of resistance we would need in order to achieve a 3 amp current flow? We have a 36-volt source. It's 12, right? So how did you do that? Don't know. Okay, so these are the different resistors you can use, but I was just asking before we use those resistors, how much total resistance do we have to have in the circuit in order to match it to the light bulb? 12, right? Because 36 divided by 12 is going to equal the 3 amps that we need. Of course, they don't give you a 12-amp resistor, but they give us, say, a 12-ohm resistor. They give us an 8-ohm resistor and a 4-ohm resistor. And if I do that, I get a light bulb that works, okay? Also, because in serial they're additive, I could do all kinds of different things. I could take 4 plus 4 plus 2 plus 1 plus 1, right? I get the light bulb to work. So that's 12 again, right, because they're additive. Now let's say I didn't count right, and I only get 11 ohms of resistance. Still doesn't work. Okay, two questions, yes.
So how come we had all the same resistance as you had on your own? Why wasn't our resistance additive?
Right, it should be. You know what? This gets into parallel resistors, which are coming up next, but where we touch those little prongs, there's a very small amount of surface area that touches, meaning it's for the water analogy, it's a very narrow hose. But when each of you were touching each other's hands, unless you had some kind of weird phobia, you probably weren't going like that. You actually touched with a fairly large surface area. So the conductance between, you know, across the resistance across two individuals was much lower than the resistance at either endpoint. Okay. Yes?
Can you explain the voltage drop thing?
Okay.
So we have...
So would it work on this side?
Sure, it would work. Let me make it just a little simpler, okay? Let's do this. So there's 12. Works? Works. Okay. So now we know that the total resistance in this circuit is 4 plus 4 plus 2 plus 2, because these resistors are in series. So we just simply add them up. Total resistance is 12. Source voltage is 36. So the current running through there is 36 divided by 12, or 3 amps. So now the question is, how much of the voltage drops across each of the resistors? And for that, we would need to multiply current by resistance. So if I took my volt ohmmeter and I measured here, the voltage drop across this resistor would be the 3 amps that are flowing times 4, or 12 volts drop here. Okay. Again, 12 volts drop here. 3 amps times 2 ohms is going to give me a voltage drop now of 6, and another of 6. Okay. So 6 plus 6 plus 12 plus 12 adds up to the 36 volts initially.
Sorry, this might be a stupid question, but if you have a voltage drop of 36,
Now, in reality, this would have some resistance, and there would be a voltage drop across it, too, or it couldn't work. But for this simple example, it has next to no resistance. Okay.
Oh, okay, I get that. Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but then where does the, if it's the voltage is dropped, then where is
well, that's there would have to also be a voltage drop across this. So in our real example, this might have, say, a 2 ohm resistance, for example, and then it would also be part of the series. So if we were to think about such a circuit, we might have a battery like that. No, this is definitely 2. I feel like that UPS guy on TV. Okay. So here we have our light bulb. And it's actually going to provide some kind of a resistance. So I'm going to draw it in as a resistor in the circuit. Okay. And then we put in, as part of our exercise, other resistors. So there would be a voltage drop here, a voltage drop here, and some voltage drop across that light. But for this simple example, it was just ignored. But in this simple example, as you can see, the light bulb is, in fact, in series, right? It's the current would have to flow through each resistor, then there's no break here once it's closed, and flow through here. So it's in series with those resistors. If you want to try this, the link is here. You can play with different source voltages and try to understand what will happen with your light bulb. Okay. So you can just keep doing it empirically, but eventually I hope you'll be able to calculate it ahead of time and save some light bulbs. All right. Okay. So now we come to the idea of parallel circuits. And if we go back to the water analogy, then what's going on here is, in the original example, there was simply a single pathway for the current to flow, and then the amount of resistance would determine that current flow. But now we have this example, there are three different spaces for the current to flow. So you would imagine there should be greater current flow through a parallel circuit, all else being equal, than the series circuit if we have the same size resistors at each one of those turns. Okay? So in a series circuit, if we add resistors, it's like constricting and constricting and constricting that hose. Okay, it adds more resistance. In a parallel circuit, adding additional legs with a resistor does not necessarily increase the overall resistance of the circuit. And in fact, what you see in a parallel circuit is that the reciprocal of the total of resistance is equal to the sum of the reciprocal of each of those individual resistors. The reciprocal of the total is equal to the reciprocal of the sum of each of those individual resistors. So let's just imagine you start with a 5 ohm resistor in a single circuit, in a simple circuit, then the resistance is 5 ohms. But now, if you add 2 5 ohm resistors in parallel, you have 1/5 plus 1/5 is 2/5. So 2/5 is 1 over the total resistance. Total resistance is now 5/2, or 2.5. So by putting in 2 identical resistors in parallel, you've halved the overall resistance of the circuit. And in this water analogy, you're giving water more spaces to flow. It should decrease the resistance. So what that looks like then in terms of the circuit is something like this. So now we have a 50 volt source voltage, and we have 3 different resistors, and you can see they're now in parallel. And you know they're in parallel because current would not have to flow through this resistor to get through this one. And similarly, it would not have to flow through the other two to get through this one. They're in series if the current has to flow through one and then sequentially another. Okay. They're in parallel if that's not the case. Now, as we look at that then, the first thing we would want to, so there's lots of questions you could ask about this, like what's the total resistance and how much current is flowing through each of those different legs and how much current is flowing totally through the circuit. So the best place to start with something like this would be with our trusty equation that the reciprocal of the total resistance will equal the reciprocal of each of those in turn. So let me see if I can do this in a way that, so I'll recreate the circuit up here. So that's our basic circuit, and the first resistance was 25 ohms, and the next one was 10 ohms, last one was 50 ohms. Okay. And our source voltage in this was 50 volts. Decent source voltage. So in order to figure out how the current flows through here, we have to know what the total resistance of the circuit might be. And so 1 over R sub T is going to equal 1 over, and this is, we're just going to call this resistor 1, resistor 2, and resistor 3. So it'll be 1 over resistor 1 plus 1 over resistor 2 plus 1 over resistor 3. So quite simply, it's just 1 over 25 plus 1 over 10 plus 1 over 50. And of course, you have to come up with some kind of common denominator. So that would be 2 over 50 plus 5 over 50 plus 1 over 50, which is going to equal 8 over 50. And 8 over 50 comes out to some nasty number like 6 1/4, 6.25. So now our total resistance for the circuit, and I hope that made sense, is it's the equivalent. This circuit right now, I could actually redraw it as if it were simply 50 volt source and 1 6.25 ohm resistor. Right. That's the equivalent circuit for this parallel circuit. By equivalent, we're saying this is the equivalent of those other 3 legs. We're ignoring how things are different between them, but just looking, once we're looking from here to here. It's the equivalent of a 6.25 ohm resistor.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Isn't the 6.25
the reciprocal of the resistor? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. I'm sorry. It's 1/50th, right. And then I have to, and that's 1 over R sub T, right. And then if I flip it, so then 50 divided by 8 equals 6.25.
Okay,
I skipped a step.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Because you use less surface area over a shorter distance, and we use greater surface area over a larger distance, it kind of equals, is that why?
The distance wouldn't really be the issue. So we were all in a series with each other, right? So if we each were just touching little tiny bits, then it should be the case that the overall resistance would be much higher than the 1.8 megohms we reserved for just one person. But because there was a greater surface area, it's like having either a lower resistor, or you could think of it as lots of resistors in parallel. In fact, maybe at the break, if any few people want to try it, you could set yourselves up in a parallel circuit.
So if I use my,
as much as I could, but you see the trouble is those little prongs are too small to actually get very much of my skin on there. Right, but if we had had, for example, I guess we'd have one side of the room up and another row in the middle, another row here, and have a couple of connector people, we could probably reduce the overall voltage or the resistance of the circuit. Okay, so now we know the total resistance. And so the first thing we would probably want to find then in order to solve, ultimately we want to know how much current is flowing through the circuit and how much current flows through each of those three arms of this circuit. So if we want to know the I sub t, which would stand for the total current flow, then what are we going to use for that?
E over R.
E over R, right. And you said 50 volts. So E over R, and it's E subtotal over R subtotal, which is going to be 50 divided by the total equivalent resistance, 6.25, which very conveniently is 8. So, and 8 what?
8 amps.
Right. That's a pretty hefty flow, actually. Yes.
So did you calculate each of the flows for each resistor?
Yes, so if you knew the flow of each of the across each of the three resistors, you add them up, it better equal 8. But we can't calculate them individually until we know how much current is flowing through. Well, actually, I'm sorry. We could. We can calculate for each of the individual ones, that's right.
Because the voltage is the same in the parallel circuit,
in the series we couldn't. In the series we couldn't, right. So Ashley's point is if I were to take my volt ohm meter and measure here, there'd be 50 volts. I measure here, there'd be 50 volts. I measure here, there'd be 50 volts. So the voltage drop across each of those has to be the same. There's a different amount of current going through them. So, back to this. So then, that's kind of a way to double check in this circuit. So if we want to know how much current flows through arm 1, arm 2, and arm 3, we need to solve then for I sub 1, I sub 2, and I sub 3, what equation will we use for that? Right, so E over R, and that'd be 1, so that's going to equal 50 over 25, so that's going to be 2 amps, right? And for this other one, for the second one, it would equal 50 over 10, be 5 amps, and for the last one, it'd be 50 over 50, which would equal 1 amp. And so we can see 2 amps plus 5 amps plus 1 amp is in fact 8 amps. So if you go back to the water analogy, you've got 8 amps of water, 8 amps of current going, it's all going to have to be accounted for, and it goes through all these tributaries, but in the end, there's still 8 flowing. It's just a different amount for each one of those tributaries. With me so far? Any questions? Keep going? All right. Okay. All right. Okay. Now, circuits can get considerably more complex. If you've ever looked at circuit diagrams for, you know, things like coffee makers and that, you'll notice they're very complex. But this is certainly complex enough for our purposes. And if you can follow this reduction of a circuit and understanding how much current flows through different arms, then that's sufficient for what you need to know for this course. Okay. I'm going to do a quick pause while you digest the circuit.
for being able to do this is what would be able to do the exam.
Right, yes. If you could do something, this would be the hardest it would get on the exam. That's another way of saying that. Right. Okay. So, here we have, what, a 9-volt source, like our 9-volt battery. And we have a couple of parallel arms, so that's all good. But there's also a couple of other resistors here that are going to be in series. So as we look at that, you know, we might ask then, you know, how are we going to solve this, right? We've got a lot of different things that we need to reduce. So how many branches are there to this parallel circuit?
There's a parallel circuit within a parallel circuit.
No, there's series within the parallel, but there's not a parallel within the parallel. Well, so there's one here, and one here, and this one, right. We usually draw it over here, but see, it's still in parallel with these. It doesn't matter if it's drawn here or here, right? It's another path for voltage to go that doesn't have to first go through this resistor. So that would make this one parallel. We could easily just redraw this by moving it over here to the side. Parallel within a parallel would usually have like a split here, right? Or a split here.
If you redraw it this way though, isn't that, I mean, it works, you still get 9.
Let's see. So you redo this circuit this way.
Yes.
You get 20.
1/20, 1/5.
You still get 9. Okay. Oh, I see how you do it. Yeah, okay. Alright, well, it'll make more sense if people see that.
Yeah, it's the only way I understand it.
Okay. So we have the 20 and the 5 here, right? And it has to go through the 8 ohm on the way, that's right. But the 6 is in parallel with that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that, would you call that a parallel within a parallel, or is that not what that defines?
No, that would be parallel within a parallel. Mm-hmm. I just hadn't thought about looking at it that way. All right, so, and redrawing it the way she did it, it makes it easier to know where to start. But I usually, when they're drawn like this, you start farthest on the right, farthest away from the voltage source in something that's purely parallel, and reduce it. Okay. So you can start at that parallel combination of the 5K and the 20K resistors, and you replace it with its equivalent resistance. And so its equivalent resistance here is going to be 1 over the equivalent resistance is 1/20 plus 1/5, right? And that's going to be 1/20 plus 4/20, which is 5/20, or 1/4. Okay. So the reduction, the 1 over the total resistance for this part of the circuit is 1 over 4, so the total resistance equivalent to this part of the circuit is 4. Does that make sense to people? So it looks like that. All of a sudden it gets simpler. So now we have this parallel, but these two are in series. Right? So we're going to have to reduce those next before we can solve for the parallel. We have to know what that equivalent series is. Well, that's series people tend to find easier, right? You just add them up. So the equivalent resistance for this leg of the circuit is 4 plus 8, or simply 12. And now it looks like that. So that's clearly simpler. Now we're back to a relatively simple circuit, but it's still a compound, so you've got a parallel and then a series part of it. So we'll want to compute the equivalent resistance here for these two parallel arms of it. So we would have 1 over the total resistance equal to 1 over 12 plus 1 over 6. So 1 over 12 plus 1 over 6 is 1 over 12 plus 2 over 12, which is 3 over 12. and that would be, of course, 1/4. So now, 1 over total, the equivalent resistance is 1 over 4, equivalent resistance must be 4. And now we have something that looks very simple, where we simply have a 4K and a 5K resistor in series with one another, making them the equivalent resistance, now a 9K resistor. Okay? So that looks very simple. And now you could compute the current flowing through this circuit simply using that the current is the voltage divided by the resistance. You have 9 volts divided by 9 kiloohms, 9,000 ohms, and that's where you come up with 1 milliamp. Because kilo is 10 to the 3 and milli is 10 to the negative 3. So it just makes it easier. Okay, so we have now 1 milliamp of current flowing through this entire circuit, and now we would work our way back and try to figure out how much current is flowing through each of those different arms of the circuit. So we'd want to expand each arm in the same order that we collapsed it and figure out what's going on. Okay. So, first of all, this current, there's going to be, we're going to figure out voltage drops and current. There's going to be a voltage drop across each of those resistors. And you have a 5K and a 4K resistor. And so you simply take the current times the resistance to get the voltage drop. So there'll be a 4-volt drop across this resistor, and then, of course, a 5-volt drop across that resistor. So that should be pretty straightforward so far. And then, if we break that open, now we have a equivalent parallel circuit that we devised a few steps back, keeping in mind that, you know, all along this part of the circuit, the voltage drop is still 4 volts. Right? So we can determine how much current goes through each of those two arms. You know, there's a milliamp going through the entire circuit, and that has to be broken up between the two arms. And so we can simply use the formula for determining current, which is voltage divided by resistance. So we have 1 milliamp divided by 6 kiloohms, and here we have 1 milliamp divided by 12 kiloohms. And I gave the wrong formula. So what we want is to calculate the voltage drop, and that will equal the voltage 9, the voltage drop 4, divided by the resistance. We have a 4-volt drop from here to here. 4 divided by 6 is 2/3, and 4 divided by 12 is 1/3. So that's how much current would flow through each of these. So of the 1 milliamp of current, more of it goes through the path with less resistance. 2/3 of the milliamp goes through here, and 1/3 milliamp goes through this section. But now this section, of course, itself is still more complex than we make it to be here. So we back up another step, and we have really two resistors here. And when things are in series, the same amount of current flows through both the resistors. What's different is the amount of voltage that drops. And that's different. When things are in parallel, the amount of voltage drop across this, the amount of voltage drop across the different arms is the same. There's 4 volts here, there's 4 volts here, and the current flow differs. But when you're in series, the current flow between two series resistors is the same, but the voltage drop is different. So now if we would like to determine the amount of voltage drop, we know there's 1/3 milliamp flowing through this arm of the circuit, and we know that we have these two resistors, 4K and 8K. So the voltage drop will equal that current times the resistance. So that's a 4K resistor times the 1/3 milliamp here, so there's 4/3 of a volt drop here. And then we have the 1/3 milliamp still going across the 8K resistor, and the 8/3 of a volt drop there. And so there's 4/3 of a volt and 8/3 of a volt drop. So from here to here, that would be from this point to this point, would be 4/3 plus 8/3, or 12/3 of a volt drop. 12/3 would be 4 volts, so that works out as you'd expect, because there's also a 4 volt drop from here to here. All right, and then there's just one more step where we have to break it down one more time. Okay. So let's go back. So this was the equivalent 4K resistor, and that equivalent 4K resistor was really a 5K and a 20K in parallel with each other. Right. And we know that there's 1/3 milliamp of current flowing through this equivalent resistor, so now we have to decide how that's actually going to be broken up. There's 1/3 milliamp going through this whole leg, but how is it broken up? So we find then, if we do that, that the amount of current flowing through the 20K resistor is going to equal the 4/3 volt drop divided by the 20K resistor, which is 4/60 of a milliamp, or just 1/15 of a milliamp current goes through there. The bigger resistor of the two, so we see less current. Whereas here, we have our 4/3 of a volt drop again, but only a 5K resistor, and so 4/3 divided by 5K is 4/15 of a milliamp. So we have 4/15 of a milliamp going through here, 1/15 of a milliamp here. We sum those, 4/15 and 1/15 gives us 5/15, which would reduce to 1/3. So again, 1/3 milliamp. So you can think of that there's a milliamp in the whole circuit. It comes along here, 2/3 is going through this leg, 1/3 through the rest. Through the rest, well, 4/15 goes through here, 1/5 goes through here. When they sum again, 1/3 coming here, and when the 2/3 and the 1/3 meet here, again, we're back to 1 milliamp. So, summarizing the current through the battery then, we calculated the total circuit to have a current of 1 milliamp. If you wanted to go back and say, what's the current through the 8K resistor, we calculate, or the 1/3 milliamp going through the 8K resistor, voltage difference across that, 8/3 of a volt, voltage difference across the 20K resistor, 4/3 of a volt. So this would be kind of a way that you could test your knowledge. I can give you a whole circuit and then ask you a few questions like that. So you just have to solve the circuit in its entirety, and then once you solve it, just be able to look it up straight away. So that's known as a compound circuit because it has both series and parallel parts to it. So in real life, these things aren't devoid of application. There are series circuits and parallel circuits all the time. But this one's kind of interesting. This comes from the 1990 version of your handbook. And they were, you know, at that time showing what would have been a very realistic utilization of a parallel circuit in the laboratory. So here's some kind of a battery, or it could have been wall voltage, but let's say battery, so you don't have any current possibly going to the subject. And then there's a video display, maybe. They're looking at, some kind of, you're looking at signals coming on the screen. There would be a slide projector back then to present your stimuli to subjects. There might have been a tape player to play the instructions. And some kind of a signal lamp to tell the subject to go. So this would have been a more primitive laboratory. Now all of this could be handled within one computer, of course. But that would be the idea, that you'd have one source voltage running all these different things, so they would be in parallel, and you'd have to make sure that you have adequate source voltage and given the resistances of these different devices so that you can power them all appropriately. Series circuit would be something simple like this. You'd turn a light on and off. Now, simple series circuit could easily be thought of as a response button for a subject. There's a source voltage, and they press the button, and it closes the switch. There's obviously some resistance built into it. If it's illuminating a little lamp when they press it, then that would provide some resistance as well. Of course, there are both series and parallel circuits in your house as well. Here's one example of something kind of, it's still kind of archaic, but commonly used, and that would be holiday lights. Okay. So the old holiday lights were of the sort that when one light bulb went out, the whole thing went out. So each light bulb was one resistor in series. And one light bulb goes out, and now the current stops flowing, and you're stuck trying to figure out which light bulb it is, or you just buy a new set of lights. Now, you'll notice that most lights that you would buy have two wires, and they're kind of, twisted in between each other, and those two wires allow there to be, each light bulb be a parallel part of that circuit. So if one light bulb goes out, the current can still flow through the others just fine. Okay. Let me pause and see if people have questions. So if you go back to the electricity book, see if you could solve a series circuit, a parallel circuit, and a reasonably simple compound circuit. And the one that we did in class here is the most complex that you would have to know how to do. So this is probably a good time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about capacitance and alternating current circuits. So we'll take 15 here. Okay, let's go. All right. Okay. But before I introduce the next step, let me just see if there are still questions from basic theories of parallel circuits. I realize you may also have them after you go through the book, and or they may be on the 3x5 card. All right, so there's still a little bit of an addition to what we talked about. So the next concept I'll introduce is the concept known as capacitance. Yes?
I thought you said you were going to
draw chills. Oh, yes. Thank you. So she asked, there was a question during the break. Yeah. Why was it that the resistance decreased when we all together, tensed our toes, or even when I did it by myself? So we have, in that case, the voltometer is actually providing some battery source. It runs on batteries. And when you're testing for resistance, you're actually passing a current through the people. So you guys obviously didn't feel anything, and I didn't feel anything. It's a very small current. So it's a pretty small voltage. And it comes through here, and then I need to get a better marker. So here's our simple circuit with the one hand being here and another hand being here. Let me get this a little. Let's see if this 10 will show up, because if it does, it won't suffer from that annoying noise. So here's our. Yeah, okay. So here's. There's some resistance at one of my hands, and then for now we'll assume that there's no internal resistance at all, okay, or at least it's negligible for this circuit, because I'm filled with ionic fluids all over the place. So signals can traverse easily through me. That's why going out in a lightning storm is a bad idea, because signals will easily traverse through us. And then this would be the other hand. Okay. So each hand now has a resistance. But we can't really measure just the resistance of one hand. We'd have to be on the inside and the outside of the skin, and that would be messy. So we're really measuring the composite across the both. So we're measuring the voltage difference between those to infer the voltage drop to infer the resistance, right? So when I tense my toes, I'm momentarily decreasing this resistance. So what we haven't introduced is the concept that would be written like that, which is a variable resistor. So what? Oh, it's a top secret concept. Okay, that's a variable resistor. So it can be changed as a function of time. So, my hands aren't really resistors. What they are a series of sweat glands, and there's some base amount of sweat that happens on any live human being. And so as I touch the device, there'll be some current that can flow through. And now as I do anything that would be arousing, tell a joke, laugh, tense my muscles, run up and down the steps, there should be an increase in the amount of sweat there. And that's conductive, so that will decrease the resistance. What that does in this circuit is it momentarily decreases the resistance across here. Okay? So that's what you're seeing. And when you all did it, it was just, again, in series. Everybody was decreasing their resistors together. It was a very complex circuit, actually, but it worked. All right. All right, so now introducing the idea of capacitance. Capacitance is a way of storing, briefly, electrical charge. And a capacitor is a device that allows us to store charge, and it has two conductors. In this case, you can just think of them as metal plates, either one of which, if you hooked wires to either end, you could pass current through very easily. And something in between that doesn't conduct very well, and that's known as a dielectric. So a dielectric is a good insulator. Things like paper, for example. would be a good insulator, but is capable of passing electrical fields of force. So tin foil wouldn't be a good dielectric. Right? It would be hard to pass things through it. Plus it conducts too. But certain kinds of, if you had something that was too thick, like a thick balloon in the middle, that wouldn't work either. But something like paper, if you had plates on either side, you could imagine it could pass electromotive force across those plates. Okay? But it wouldn't conduct any actual current itself. So what happens with a capacitor then, imagine we have electrons flowing to this plate, which has ample room to store some of those extra electrons. So they start piling up here, and that creates a negative voltage, just like our balloon had a negative voltage. That plate is in very close proximity. It wouldn't be nearly so close, so far as here. It'd be in close proximity, so it's going to push away the electrons, like charges repel. It's going to push away the electrons on that plate, and so they would continue to move. So now this plate becomes relatively devoid of electrons. Okay. So it ends up having a negative and a positive charge. So a charged capacitor then has more electrons on one conductor plate than the other. And schematically, what that looks like is this. Here's our battery. current would begin to flow until that plate gets full, and then it's going to stop. So capacitors are self-limiting. If you need current to flow for a while and then slow down and trickle to a stop, then a capacitor will allow that to happen. And how much current can flow and for how long is going to be determined by the source voltage and the size of these plates. So if you have a big source voltage and a small plate, current will flow for a very short time, and then it's going to be full. If you have a small source voltage and a big plate, current can flow for a long time until it's going to be full. Okay. So these two plates then essentially offer no resistance to the signal, even though, because they're close enough in space, even though no electrons are actually going across that plate. So the negative charge gets built up on this first plate due to a flow of electrons, and a positive charge is built up on the second one because the electrons continue to flow. And so the current charges the plates of this capacitor, but does not actually flow through the capacitor. And that's the one I think. Okay. So this is what it might look like. So I have a circuit here that has a source voltage battery like we've seen. And at step one, up here, we would see that current would flow. This is flowing in the direction of electrons now. And so you see, coming from this battery, it could flow. And if this plate is not charged, it would accept some electrons and then push some electrons off this plate, and it would continue to flow around to the battery. Okay? And that would be very happy until the plate got full, and then it would just stop. Okay? But that plate now would be charged. There'd be a negative charge here and a positive charge here. So if I then took the switch and flipped it this way, now all of these stored charges here can flow, the electrons can flow towards the positive end here. So what happens in this circuit is the initial current is flowing counterclockwise, like that, till it's fully charged. Flip the switch, and it flows the other direction, like this. Okay. I'll show you an example of with an animation of that in just a moment. Okay, so clearly the size of the plate matters. So looking at these two, which would have more capacity? Well, obviously the one with the larger plate. Assuming they're made of the same material, this one would be able to store more electrons, so it would have more capacity to store charge. So with a larger capacity, the current will flow for a longer period of time before it stops, before that capacitor is fully charged. Now, when you have a capacitor, then you can describe that current flow as a function of time using something called a time constant. And there are two ways to say what a time constant is. So let's back up just a second. Looking at this circuit, what's going to happen is current is going to flow until this capacitor gets full. Then the current flow will slow and eventually come to a halt. So we could describe that function as current flow as a function of time. And so that would be one way to describe this. So here is capacitor current as a function of time. And initially, there's a fair amount of current. And, you know, with these, as they start to charge up, it starts to drop off, and it has this kind of function like this. And when the current flow gets to 63.2% of its, it's slowed by 63.2%. In other words, it's now 36.8% of what it was, of what it was originally. That we call it, we can look at the time that it would take for that, and we call that the time constant. So the time constant is just going to tell you how quickly the current slowing occurs. That's a bad way to say it. Time constant is going to tell you how long current can flow for. Now, current will continue to flow after the time indicated by the time constant, but it's much smaller at that point. So, when the current flow has dropped 63.5% from its starting value, you look down, how long did it take to do that? That's the time constant of a capacitor. So capacitors with longer time constants allow the current to flow unabated for a longer period of time, and they have the ability to store more charge. Now, the other way to describe it, and you're going to get the same result, but you might be measuring a different feature of it, is how much voltage the capacitor is storing. So if we go back to this idea, initially, the capacitor, the plates, are equally charged. But when we connect it to the battery source, now charge starts to accumulate. And eventually, they won't be able to hold anymore, and there won't be any change in the voltage of the capacitor. So if we look at that as a function, here would be the capacitor voltage. If you're checking the voltage across the two plates of the capacitor, it starts at zero, and as the capacitor begins to charge, you accumulate charge on one plate relative to the other. That rises and then starts to slow down. So you can also describe the time constant in terms of how long it takes for the capacitor to reach 63.2% of its maximum charge. And you just say, okay, here's 63.2%, and there's a time associated with that. That time will be the same time associated with this time based upon current flow. So there's two ways of describing the same thing. A longer time constant means it will hold more charge. Mm-hmm.
I might have missed it. Where did you get 63.2?
That's just a well-known fact. 63.2% is if power is amplitude squared. How does that work? I think if you square 63.2, no, that doesn't equal 0.5. There's something about 63.2. Would you put that on your 3x5 card and I will find out for you? Does any electrical whiz know why it's 63.2? But if you'll ask that on your 3x5 card, I'll make sure to find out for you. I mean, you could pick, I suppose, any time, but by convention, the time constant has been picked to be 63.2% of the full charge of the capacitor, or a 63.2% reduction in the current flow.
Over 1 second?
No, it's the time it takes to get 63.2% charged. So it's in seconds. It could take, if I have a tiny capacitor, it could be a fraction of a second. If I have a big capacitor, it could be a matter of many seconds. Let me show you the animated diagram.
Know when it becomes 63.2%
charged. Ah, okay. Well, let's say I know that this capacitor, when fully charged, so I've used it a bunch, and I know that it can hold 10 volts of charge. Okay. So when it gets to be 6.32 volts, I know that now it's 63.2% charged.
But
how do I know it holds 10 initially?
No. It seems like a weird number to want to know. Like,
right.
Why would you need to know? Okay, I want to know when it's fully charged. I don't know.
You might want to know when it's fully charged.
Well,
right.
Obviously, be 10, but.
Well, I mean, it could take different capacitors could hold, they could hold 10 volts, but they might take different amounts of time to get there. Okay. So
why don't you want to know how long it takes for it to get fully charged, rather than how long it takes for it?
Well, because you can see there's this, you know. You're going to be waiting a long time for it to get fully charged. So its useful life is kind of gone at that point. So I guess another way of saying this is from 0 to 63.2, you might see, you know, reasonable increases in voltage and reasonable current flow. But at some point out here, the amount of current flow is negligible. The amount of voltage increase is negligible. That's not a very useful range for the capacitor. And I wish I had the 63.2 number for you, but I'd be making it up if I tried to tell you that now. Okay. So, I'll say this, and then I'm going to show you how this fits in with capacitance. So everything we've talked about until we got to capacitor was the idea of direct current, or you can think of it as one-way current. Current flowed in one direction. Okay. And that's how batteries work. There's a positive end and there's a negative end. And unless you flip your battery around, the current doesn't change direction. But current coming out of the wall is alternating current. And that means that the direction of current flow changes with some kind of periodicity. And so the frequency of the wall current here in North America is 60 cycles per second. In Europe and much of the rest of the world, it's 50 cycles per second. So at either 50 hertz or 60 hertz, it means 50 or 60 times per second, the direction of the current flow is changing. And it changes at a given frequency given in hertz. 1 hertz is 1 cycle per second, 60 hertz, 60 cycles per second. And when we look at an AC signal then, we can measure it in terms of the peak-to-peak voltage as a function of time. So you can see that, you know, there's positive voltage and then negative voltage on this waveform, and how quickly it oscillates back and forth between them tells you the frequency of the signal. And it's, instead of a battery illustration here, it's this little squiggly line like this to indicate an alternating current generator. So we don't think of the brain as generating DC signals. We think of the brain as generating AC signals. So that's why this becomes important. Now, if we think about alternating current and capacitors, actually, before I get to the rapidly alternating signals, let me show you these two applets, because I think they are really quite useful for understanding what's going on with capacitors. Okay. So, probably made by Duracell, this little animation. So you can see there's a battery here. And so if we just had a simple circuit, current would flow a particular direction. Okay, check the electrons would flow from positive to negative. Right now there's an open switch, so nothing's going to happen. But in here we have a capacitor. So if I close the switch in this direction, then current will flow into the capacitor, begin charging up the plate, and continue to push, and eventually it will slow down, and we'll have a charged capacitor. So if we move the switch on the battery, that was pretty fast, but the battery charges the capacitor until now the capacitor has the same voltage as the battery, so there's no more current flow. And now if we switch it to the other loop, now we should see the electrons flow from one side of the capacitor to the other. And they float. It's very fast, isn't it? So there you go. Charges the capacitor, and back it goes. Charge the capacitor, and back it goes. So this would be one way, of course, to generate alternating current if you needed to transfer DC current to AC current by routinely flipping a switch back and forth, and you would get alternating current. Now, the other example here shows us how this works in terms of the time constant. So to understand this circuit, what we have here is a battery here that has 10 volts source voltage. We have a switch here, so currently nothing from the battery can flow because there's a break there. I'll flip the switch in just a moment. If I were to flip the switch, then there's a resistor here, and then here's a capacitor right here. And the capacitor then would start to accumulate charge when I flip that switch. And we'll see here voltage on the y-axis as a function of time. So start it, nothing happening yet until I flip the switch. And now you see things are flowing. Where's the red line? Let's put a red line there. Try it again. There we go. There's a red line coming. So now you see that the capacitor is beginning to charge, and that's shown here, right? So it's that the current is flowing, capacitor is charging, and you might see also that the current is slowing down. as the capacitor is starting to reach its capacity. Eventually, this will go all the way to 10 volts, at which point the current should just stop. And we can see up here now it's almost to 100% of its voltage.
So is like the point of a capacitor to just like be another battery, or like why would you?
Well, it with alternating current, it allows us to allow certain kinds of signals to pass and other kinds of signals not to pass. And so I'll show that in just a moment. But you can use it to filter out slow frequencies or filter out high frequencies, depending on how you set up the circuit. Okay, so now current has all but ground to a halt. It's still not at 10 volts. So you see, if you really used your time to actually fully saturate the capacitor, you'd have a long wait. So now it's, for all intents and purposes, fully charged. If I were to then flip the switch this other direction, we would expect now the current to go the other direction. So we'll take the battery out of the equation, and the current was, there are electrons that have accumulated here. So if I flip this switch, it will go around this way, right? And we'll see the voltage drop. So now we see the voltage dropping up here as it discharges. Go towards zero as well. Okay. And of course you could, you know, flip it back and forth a couple times and it would start up again from where it left off. Maybe. Yeah. It's filling up, now it's coming back up. Oh, come on. It's going back down. So you can see how it, you know, goes back and forth. So I'm making a very crude alternating current circuit. You can see the current goes one way, then the other, one way, then the other, by doing this. You see voltage increases, voltage decreases on the capacitor. Does that make sense? So the capacitor is just storing charge temporarily, and then if you allow the circuit to change, then that charge can be dissipated. Have any of you ever played with capacitors, either intentionally or inadvertently? Computers and other electronic equipment have capacitors in them, and sometimes after you unplug the device, the capacitor still takes a very long time to discharge. And if you're not careful and you, for example, get your screwdriver across a couple terminals, you can get a big, you know, spark or shock from the capacitor. So oftentimes, if you're working on a computer, it's recommended you unplug the power from the back, hit the power button, so it tries to boot up and power starts to flow, and you know, you'll even get a little flicker of a few lights and then nothing will happen. That tends to discharge all the capacitors then before you start playing around with the electronics.
Mm-hmm. Does the capacitor kind of start to double the action of the battery? I mean, if that resistor were a light bulb, you're kind of getting double life out of it because you get it when the battery flows toward the capacitor, and then you flip the switch, and then you're using the capacitor instead of the battery. Or does the math work out such that if that capacitor wasn't there, it would still use it up at the same rate? Do you see
what Yeah, no, I see what you're saying.
I would think it would be the same rate. Maybe not, and that's why they use...
Well, you couldn't get all the charge from the battery.
Right, and you'd have a light bulb that would kind of go like a brownout in New York City. But if you developed a nice enough circuit, you could have it changing direction fast enough that you wouldn't notice. Right. Yeah, right. But if it were faster than the human eye could perceive, maybe it would be okay. Well, let's see. So what happens if we flip this switch? Let's see. So we can look at the voltage drop across the resistor, which will tell us if there's work to be done, I guess. So there's a lot of voltage dropping across the resistor, right? Mm-hmm. And that's all coming from the capacitor. Mm-hmm. We're not using any battery power. And now we're going back up again. You'd have to have some kind of a device that could tolerate some voltage fluctuations that have a large range that would work in with these voltage fluctuations.
So it would be the same if you took out that capacitor, it would use energy at the same rate?
Yes, it should. Okay, so if you want to play with this a little bit more to get an intuitive sense of time constants, this too is linked into the slides. So if we think of then slowly alternating signals, if a signal were going back and forth and back and forth, it might saturate the capacitor or it might not, depending on how large the plates of the capacitor are and how fast the signal is. So if you have a very slow signal, especially relative to the capacitor, then it's going to fully charge the capacitor and current will stop. Okay, so the signal will be going, you know, oscillating back and forth, back and forth. If the capacitor charges before it can do that oscillation, then the current will stop. But if it's going much faster, then the capacitor will not impede that signal at all, and it will pass unabated. Okay. So rapidly alternating signals will not fully charge a capacitor before the direction of flow reverses, and the signals can pass unimpeded, but slow signals then will be impeded. And so this is a nice way to use capacitors to help filter out slow or fast signals, depending on how you set this up. It's probably best to start with the next slide. This one's a little easier to understand. Okay. Here we have some alternating current source. Okay. It could be some oscillatory activity in the brain, for example. And here we have a capacitor, and that capacitor is in series with the signal. So the signal is going to have to pass through that capacitor. There's a resistor in parallel. And then out here would be our amplifier. So this is the voltage out. And we would be measuring from these two points. We'd be measuring the current at those two points. Now, if we imagine that there's a very fast signal, then it will go this direction. A few electrons will accumulate. It'll come back this direction. Those electrons will be removed. It'll go this direction. Electrons will accumulate. Go back this direction. The electrons will be removed. In other words, the signal won't be impeded at all as it goes across there. Okay, so just go back and forth as if that's really nothing. It's like no resistance at all. So that means fast signals would be able to pass across here, and you would be able to see them out here, okay, if you're measuring out here. Now, on the other hand, low slow signals in this case would, you know, slowly lumber along here, charge up the capacitor, and stop. Okay. Then the direction of current flow reverses. Then, okay, they discharge until, again, this plate saturates, and now it stops. Okay. And then it switches again. But what would happen is that this is going to start interfering with the very low frequency signals because the capacitor will be saturated. So the current would flow up to a point and then it would grind to a halt or a near halt. And then it would switch directions and you'd see a little current again and then it would again grind to a halt. So low signals would not be able to pass and therefore they wouldn't be seen out here. So if you're interested in higher frequency signals, this would be a way to see only the high frequency signals and not the low frequency signals. And so for those of you who've worked with any kind of equipment like this, a high frequency, a filter that you use on an amplifier would be like this. It would be the high pass filter. If you haven't worked with psychophysics equipment, you might think about the bass and the treble knob, you know, on your amplifiers. So let's assume you just had only a bass and a treble knob, and let's assume that, you know, they worked to really differentiate your signals. Then you might imagine trying to getting to capture the high frequency signals that you could then amplify or not amplify. You could set up something like this. So the bass and the bass drum and other low sounds wouldn't make it to this amplifier. Only the higher frequencies would, and then as you turn up the amplification, you hear just the high frequencies coming out. Okay. So that's a high-pass filter, and the simplest thing to remember here is that in a high-pass filter, the capacitor is in series with the source. Now, if we go back to this other circuit, all that's happened is the resistor has changed places, right? So this is the one you just saw, capacitor here in series, resistor in parallel. So this way, now we have capacitor in series and resistor in serial. Okay. Now what's going to happen to this one? Well, one thing you need to know is that electricity will take the path of least resistance. And a capacitor offers really no resistance at all. And any amplifier device is going to offer some degree of resistance. Okay. So high frequency signals then, as they go along here, if given the choice of this pathway, which involves some resistance, you know, there would be a device here that connects them to measure the voltage. It would have a resistance in it. Then they will take this pathway and pass unimpeded. But because they do that, you'd never be able to measure them over here. But low frequency signals, on the other hand, would find this path to be full of resistance. They couldn't traverse that path, so they will be seen out here at the amplifier. So when you put a capacitor in parallel with your signal, then this is going to allow low frequencies to pass, and it will attenuate the high frequencies. So this is a summary slide here. The next one just shows you a little more just kind of basic schematic that low pass, you have the resistor in series, capacitor in parallel. And if this were your original signal, there's a slow frequency oscillation here, but superimposed on it is a higher frequency. Those higher frequencies would easily traverse here and never make it on, whereas the low frequencies wouldn't. So this would be the signal that you might see as a result of that. Whereas the high pass filter puts the capacitor in series, so the low frequency signals won't be able to traverse out of it. And what you'll see then are just those high frequency oscillations, the ones that are fairly quick here, and that slow frequency oscillation is filtered out. So this might be the result that you'd see from that. So with all the different signals we'll talk about, we'll be talking about filter settings, because signals have different frequency characteristics. Skin conductance is very slow, EEG is quite fast, EMG is faster yet, so we'd want to ensure that we set our filter settings appropriately, but they're all based upon these simple concepts. Any questions on capacitance? Actually, if we just go back to this example for a minute, you know, you might imagine, without getting into the details of the time course, you could have, you're recording something on top of the head, and there's an alternating current generator inside the brain, for example, but there are also alternating current generators out here in the muscle activity. So the EMG is producing some signal, and the EEG is producing some signal. Let's assume the slower signal is EEG, and the faster one is EMG on top of it. Of course, the electrode sits here and it picks up everything. But if you use the appropriate filter, then you could get rid of, in this case, get rid of the EMG, see the EEG. In this case, get rid of the EEG and see the EMG. Because that assumes they don't overlap at all. But they're fairly distinct depending on what you're looking for. So you might be able to use filters then to tease apart those different signals. Okay. We're talking about bioelectrical signals, so we're done with the electrical part. We can move to the bio part. And I'm going to spend the rest of today's lecture and probably a bit of next time on neurophysiology, and then I'll just have a brief review of neuroanatomy. So many of the signals that are generated, at least in terms of EEG signals, are going to come from understanding the neurophysiology of the central nervous system. And as you look inside the brain, there are three basic units. There are glial cells, which are structural and metabolic support inside the brain. There's extracellular space, which isn't really space, it's filled with fluid. And if it was space, we'd be in trouble, you'd have a nasty headache and things wouldn't work very well. And then finally, there's the neuron. And this is really, you know, the workhorse of the central nervous system. And there are three different types of neurons in the central nervous system. There's sensory, motor, and interneurons, just based upon their function. So this is a highly schematized diagram here, where you can imagine out at the periphery there's some kind of a sense organ. In this case, it's a pain receptor in the finger as this person touches a hot object. The pain receptor can immediately detect that there's been some tissue damage, and then there's a signal sent along the neuron, the sensory neuron, to the spinal cord. Okay. And in the case of the pain neuron, there's a synapse at the spinal cord. At that point, that's the end of the sensory neuron. In the spinal cord here, there's an interneuron, and we can think of most of the brain as interneuron, by the way. And then finally, out here is a motor neuron that, if stimulated, would cause some contraction, and reflexively, the person could withdraw their hand from the hot object. So the impulses coming in are sensory neurons, and efferent activity going out is going to be motor neurons, and everything else in between is interneuron. And as you look at some simple thing like this, sometimes people would ask, well, you know, the neuron in the middle, might that not get in the way of a fast response? It's going to take extra time for this signal to get into the central nervous system, and with this neuron in the way, it's going to take extra time before the motor response can occur. But of course, without that interneuron, then this system would always work this way no matter what. Pain withdraw, pain withdraw, pain withdraw, pain withdraw. And that's probably an adaptive response, but there'd be times when that should be overridden, right? You're holding something breakable, and you also have some pain. You wouldn't want to just drop it. You're holding your baby, and you know something. You touch something hot. You don't drop the baby. You do something different. So interneurons give us the possibility of being something other than a stimulus response device. So if you think of the whole brain as one elaborate network of interneurons, it's all about modulating how we respond to our environment in ways that are not entirely pre-programmed or hardwired. And so if you look at it that way, you know, 99.99% of neurons in the central nervous system are interneurons. Right? They're mostly about things in between sensory input, afferent activity, and motor output, efferent activity. All right, so those are the three types, motor, sensory, and interneuron. Now, they vary widely, different neurons do, whether they're sensory or motor neurons or interneurons. But they all seem to have certain features in common. So here we see just a few different kinds of neurons and how different they look from each other. So here we have a neuron from the retina of the eye. Here we have one from the cortex. Here we have one from the spinal cord. You know, their shapes are different. Their kind of degree of length of the axon is different. But they all share certain features in common. And those common features are going to be a cell body, so dendrites, which are receptive organs, and axons, which are going to convey the message to the next organ. So as you look here, at kind of a schematized neuron, here's the cell body, which is going to, of course, take care of many of the metabolic needs of the cell. There are dendrites out here, and they look kind of like a tree. So, you know, dendrite has some root that means tree, dendritic branching, things you see in trees. And these are going to be abutting many other neurons, or specifically the axons for the most part of other neurons, to receive impulses. And then coming out, there is, depending on the neuron, a long or at least modestly long axon that is then going to send signals to the next neuron. And at the very end, the axon will terminate in several little terminal buttons or axon terminals. And these will be adjacent then to other cell dendrites or other cell bodies. Okay. Now, as you look at the axon, there are a couple of characteristics here that you see. In humans, many of our neurons are myelinated, and they really look like little hot dog coverings, mm-hmm. right? They're just fatty substances that insulate the axon. And the net result of this is that it speeds the transmission of the signal down the axon. So if you need a signal to go down the axon quickly, there's two ways to do it, one of which is to increase the surface area of that axon, so fatter axons are going to conduct a signal more quickly, and the other would be to myelinate it, and it causes the signal to kind of jump to these gaps, and these gaps are called the nodes of Ranvier. And so it's an economical method for facilitating signal transmission, because if we didn't have a myelinated spinal cord, our spinal cord would be about the size of our trunk, and which wouldn't leave room for anything else. So then you imagine we would be even bigger than we as a country are becoming already. So it would be rather sizable. And this is just a fatty sheet. Myelin degeneration is something you see, for example, in multiple sclerosis. At the end, and then there are these nodes of Ranvier in between the chunks of the myelin sheet. Within the axon, there are microtubules as well that allow communication up with the cell body. And finally, and importantly for what we'll be talking about in terms of recording signals from the central nervous system, are these terminal buttons, or you can think of them as synaptic knobs because they abut the synapse. So if we now zoom in, so here's an axon coming down with those little fatty sheaths of myelin there and the nodes of Ranvier in between, and you zoom in, you can see here just a couple, but of course a real axon would have hundreds of thousands of these terminals. They come very close, but not touching, to another cell, in this case a cell body, but often a dendrite. And this is called the synapse. It's the gap between them. And at the end, there's this terminal, this axon terminal. And the final term here that we can mention is a nerve. And a nerve is simply a bundle of many axons. So they all course together in a long path together. Now, there are two types of communication within the central nervous system. There's axonal conduction and synaptic conduction. Axonal conduction is within the neuron, and synaptic transmission between the neurons. And although many people who record electrophysiological signals invasively can record action potentials and things within the axon, human psychophysiology does not. It records mostly the results of synaptic transmission. They're both an electrochemical process, but you can think of them roughly as axonal conduction as electrochemical, because the electrical changes are primarily what distinguish it, and synaptic transmission is chemical-electrical, because it's the chemical messengers that go between the neurons that provoke the electrical changes in the postsynaptic neuron. So let me talk about each of those in turn. The reason this whole thing works is because there's a resting potential. Each neuron is like a battery. It has a charge. The inside of it is relatively negative with respect to the outside of the cell. If that weren't the case, there wouldn't be the possibility of axonal conduction, and the central nervous system wouldn't work particularly well. Now, this arises from the fact that there are differential concentrations of ions inside and outside of a neuron, and there's a semi-permeable membrane there at the surface of the neuron. So inside, we can see, most importantly, there's lots of these little potassium ions, these Ks, K pluses. Okay? They're all over the place. There's a few chloride ions. Outside, there's comparatively few potassium, but many, many sodium ions. Okay? So if this membrane didn't interfere with the transfer of ions back and forth across, then what you'd expect is through osmotic pressure, sodium would be pushed into the cell because there's more sodium here than here, and potassium would be pushed out of the cell because there's more potassium inside the cell than out. But the membrane at rest doesn't allow that to happen freely, so it prevents that osmotic pressure from taking place. So that's the concentration gradient, that there's more potassium inside the cell, there's more sodium outside the cell, and they're trying to push their way in and out of the cell. Okay. The other force that's operating is an electromotive force, and this is back to the old like charges repel and opposite charges attract. And so if we go back to look at that just one more time, the inside of the cell is slightly negative with respect to the outside, so there's negativity here. These sodium ions are positively charged, so that's an opposite charge and it will be attracted. So the sodium, not only is the osmotic pressure trying to push it into the cell, but because the inside of the cell is already negative, the electromotive force would also try to push it into the cell. So if this membrane ever allowed sodium to go through, which it does at the time of the action potential, sodium has two forces acting to push it inside the cell. Potassium, on the other hand, is positive, so the electromotive force is going to work to keep potassium in the cell when the cell is at rest. Okay. But if the cell were to momentarily become positive inside, then it would push potassium out. Help push potassium, or potassium would be attracted out. Okay. Now, there is an equilibrium potential for any neuronal membrane, and it has to do with the concentration of ions that are there and the valence of the ion. And it's not important to know this in particular, but given the concentration outside the cell and inside the cell and the ionic valence, you can determine what that resting potential is for any given ion. So there's a resting potential for sodium, there's a resting potential for potassium, there's a resting potential for chloride. Every one of them has a resting potential. And then they all are pushing together to create the resting potential of the entire neuron. So you can actually look at this in terms of something that might scare you or might intrigue you, which is an electrical circuit. So this is the Hodgkin and Huxley model of the neuron. It's not, you know, a 100% bona fide anatomically correct model, but it's a useful model for thinking about the resting potential and how that changes over time. So the membrane is diagrammed here as a capacitor, and there is a battery or a voltage source for each of the different players in the resting potential. So the overall resting potential of the membrane is minus 90 millivolts. This is, I think, in a squid. In humans, it's a little bit closer to zero. It's about minus 70, if I'm not mistaken. Now, here's potassium. If potassium were the only piece in the equation, its resting potential would be at minus 97, a little bit more negative, or we say a little bit more polarized, okay? A little bit more away from zero. Sodium, on the other hand, if it were the only player in the equation, would have a resting potential of positive 66 millivolts. So it would be depolarized and positive, meaning that instead of being negative inside the cell with respect to the outside, be positive inside the cell with respect to outside. Okay. Now, there are resistors, though, preventing sodium from having much of an influence. This is a pretty big resistor at rest, and resistor preventing potassium from having much of an influence at rest. Okay, I'm going to pause for tape. EM is the resting membrane potential, so this is the sum of the sum of the whole thing. Okay. So if there were a momentary change to drop this resistance to sodium, then the resting potential of the potential of sodium would have a big influence and cause the overall membrane potential to go positive. If there were a change in potassium, it would drive it more negative. And this is what happens over time with the action potential, is there's a quick change in the permeability of the membrane, and that's just diagrammed as a variable resistor here. Okay. So actually, here's the interactive link of this. All this is going to show you is over time what happens to the overall voltage relative to the initial baseline. So here, instead of minus 90, they start at 0 volts. And so this is the quick change that happens with an action potential. So you can see that there's a momentary increase in voltage inside the cell, followed by a decrease and return to 0. But for the purpose of the Hodgkin and Huxley model, instead of looking at voltage, let's look at the sodium current. As soon as the action potential begins, there's an influx of sodium current going into the cell before it comes back and then shuts off again. Potassium, on the other hand, a little delayed to start, and that current outside the cell flows out of the cell. And then there's some leakage current as well. But you can see how the sodium current coming in offset by the potassium current going out as a function of the action potential. So that's what happens at axonal conduction. So there's a process known as depolarization. That is, if the resting potential is upset and it's depolarized a bit, moving towards zero, it can cause the action potential to occur. So here we have the resting potential, and if nothing happens, it just stays there. But if there's enough of a depolarization, there'll be some threshold here, and we could say it might be right around here. If we don't exceed the threshold, nothing happens. But if the threshold is exceeded, then there's this irreversible process where there'll be a rapid depolarization and even hyperpolarization. So it goes not only to zero, but positive inside the cell with respect to outside, and quickly returns back to baseline, a little bit of an undershoot, and back here over the course of a few milliseconds. So it's a very rapid occurrence. So what's going to happen here during this phase is you're going to have a rapid influx of sodium, and then here there'll be the outflow of potassium that's driving that back down. Um, So that threshold has to be met. And the place where it has to be met is the axon hillock, which is just where the axon meets the cell body. And that's where the whole thing will begin. And that's when then you see these sodium ions come rushing in, and they result in this action potential, and it's an all or none phenomenon. So this is kind of a diagram of what might happen. So we see that there's some kind of influence on the cell that might cause it to depolarize. And right here at the axon hillock, if it reaches that point and it's depolarized enough, then it jumps across the nose of Ranvier here down to the terminal button. That would be the process of axonal conduction. Actually, the way this was diagrammed, it looks like it's jumping across the myelin. It should jump in little gaps in between. Okay.
So is the axon hillock essentially kind of adding up all the charges that the
That's right, and it sums both spatially and temporally. So if there's some depolarization, but it's not enough to trigger an action potential, if another signal comes in that causes further depolarization before it's gone back down to the resting potential, then the sum of them over time can exceed the threshold they'll be firing. It could also be spatially that, you know, inputs from one neuron certainly won't be enough, but if there's inputs from many different neurons across many different dendrites, and even parts of the cell body, and those sum spatially, then if it exceeds the threshold again, it will fire. Okay. And so it's an all or none. Once it happens, it's all or none, and it's very high frequency. And it's so high frequency that we won't see it at the surface of the scalp. And then after, there are somewhat slower potentials, these hyperpolarizing potentials. Okay. And if we look at the change in the membrane permeability, this is just, again, going back to the Hodgkin and Huxley model, if you will, is that As the action potential begins, there is a change in conductivity or permeability for sodium. So sodium can easily traverse the membrane, and that's very short-lived. And it's followed by a slower potassium permeability increase and recovery as well. And because it's so brief, it's not as though all of the sodium ions outside go rushing into the cell and there are none left. It's a very small number of ions that actually cross the membrane, but it's enough to cause these voltage changes. And then what it does is this propagates along the axon. So here's a diagram. You can see how these red dots are going to be sodium, and I guess the blue ones will be potassium. And so as it begins, some sodium rushes into the cell, and if it does so here, it depolarizes this section, and that's enough to depolarize the next section, the next, the next, and the next. So as that membrane crosses the threshold, it changes its permeability, and that allows the sodium to rush in. And so you can see the change in voltage as it goes down the axon. And if it were myelinated, it would just jump some of the gaps as it went. The final thing to mention about axonal conduction is that there is a period of time, a refractory period, where you can't get another action potential. Otherwise, you know, this thing could get locked into a state of firing. And so, if the threshold is here, there'll be a period of time at which the membrane potential is higher than the threshold, and it can't fire again until it actually drops under threshold. And even then, it usually won't fire until a little bit of time after that. So there's this refractory period where another firing is not possible. Otherwise, if it were always the case that when you exceeded threshold it would fire, then once you exceeded threshold it would just fire until everything became depleted and it wouldn't be a very adaptive system. But, you know, the time here is really on the order of several milliseconds, and so firings can occur quite rapidly. And it's not like a refractory period of, you know, hours or anything like that. Okay, so that's the axonal conduction. And if we then look at synaptic transmission, that describes now what happens once the signal gets down the axon to the synaptic gap or the synaptic cleft, the space in between them. And this is not an all or none phenomenon. It's a graded phenomenon. And so what we look at where one axon terminates with an axon terminal blown up in a highly schematized fashion here, this would be one axon terminal here. And within the axon terminal, importantly, are these little storage vesicles, and these vesicles contain neurotransmitters in them. So you can think of them as little self-contained water balloons, except instead of water, you've got dopamine or serotonin. And as the action potential gets down to the end of the neuron, these vesicles migrate to the surface, and when they do, they kind of merge with the membrane and spill the neurotransmitter into this space, the synaptic gap or the synaptic cleft. And these neurotransmitters can bind with specific receptors on the postsynaptic cell. And when they bind, they allow an exchange of ions across the cell. And depending on what type of receptor and what kind of neurotransmitter, that can either depolarize or hyperpolarize the postsynaptic neuron, making this either more likely or less likely then to fire. So that's the synaptic vesicles migrate to the cell membrane, neurotransmitters diffuse across the cleft, it binds to a receptor, and then there's this slow postsynaptic potential that's generated. And if you were actually able to record it right there inside with respect to outside of the cell, it might be 5 to 20 millivolts at peak amplitude, and it's going to be somewhere around 6 to 50 hertz in frequency. So this was just a cartoon diagram of what happens. So you see again, once the action potential reaches it, then these little guys migrate to the surface. Here they're migrating, the anticipation is great, and they bond with the postsynaptic receptors. And if this is an excitatory neurotransmitter, then it's going to make this neuron more likely to fire by depolarizing it. Okay, enough. So the postsynaptic potentials then are of two types, excitatory and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials, EPSPs and IPSPs, excitatory and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. So here we see an example of excitatory postsynaptic potentials. And so excitatory depolarize the neuron. They make it less polarized. They move it towards zero. And here, with some kind of small input, there's a little bit of depolarization, but it obviously didn't cross the threshold, and it just returns back to baseline. Here's a little bigger depolarization, and it again depolarizes, but doesn't cross the threshold, so slowly returns to baseline. Now here's sufficient depolarization that it actually crosses the threshold, and now the action potential results. So if there were enough of these in close succession or from coming from multiple sources, there'd be spatial and temporal summation to cause the action potential to occur. Oh, not that one again. Let's see. Okay. Inhibitory, on the other hand, hyperpolarize the neuron. So if we have a small hyperpolarization, it then returns to baseline. A larger one, it returns to baseline. Larger still returns to baseline. Really large still returns to baseline. Doesn't matter how large it gets, there won't be any firing if it were solely inhibitory postsynaptic potentials occurring, because there's no threshold in this other direction. Each time, if the threshold is somewhere up here, it's moving the neuron further away from its threshold. And of course, in the real world, it's a little more complicated than that. So there's some kind of an interaction of these two. So here, imagine that in the absence of an inhibitory postsynaptic potential, there is an excitatory postsynaptic potential that crosses threshold and an action potential would occur. But now imagine that there are two inputs coming to the neuron, and just prior to the excitatory postsynaptic potential arriving, there's a bit of an inhibitory postsynaptic potential that would look like this if it were drawn on its own. So it begins, and then there's an excitatory postsynaptic potential beginning just after it, which would have been sufficient, but the sum of these two yields something that looks like this. And it doesn't cross the threshold, so it prevents it from firing. And so it's a dynamic volley of these different excitatory, inhibitory, postsynaptic potentials, and that creates oscillatory signals that then we can measure either inside the skull or at the surface of the skull if enough of them are simultaneously active. And then, as I mentioned in response to the question, there's two kinds of summation. One of them is temporal and the other is spatial. So temporal summation is just shown here, where you might have, you know, one excitatory postsynaptic potential here, but if you have two in close succession, the net result would be greater depolarization. And then spatial summation here just shows if there were just one input A, you might have some depolarization. Input B, you might have some depolarization. But if input A and B simultaneously impinge upon this neuron, there would be greater depolarization than if either one had occurred alone. And whereas the action potential is non-decremental conduction, it's the same voltage propagation all the way down the axon, the postsynaptic potentials are decremental over time and space. So they are. You need to have inputs that are sufficiently frequent and from sufficiently large sources to create enough summation to depolarize it and start an action potential. Okay. So there's decremental conduction on the dendrites and on the soma. But if the temporal and spatial summation are great enough and get to the axon hillock and the threshold is reached, then no ifs, ands, or buts, there's an action potential. Now, once those neurotransmitters get into the cleft, if they bind to the postsynaptic receptor, there has to be some mechanism to prevent them from working continuously, or otherwise the postsynaptic neuron would continue to stay excited or continue to stay inhibited. So there are two mechanisms for that after the release of the neurotransmitter that get rid of, in one way or another, the neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft. One of which is there are little evil scavengers out here, enzymes, that are going to break down the different neurotransmitters. So they're out here, and when the neurotransmitters are released, they have a short life before they're scavenged by these enzymes that break them down and degrade them into a form that won't any longer bind with the postsynaptic cell. So monoamine oxidase is one example of such an enzyme, and monoamine oxidase inhibitors are an example of drugs that are used to try to slow the degradation of neurotransmitters. They're not a first-line antidepressant, but if other things aren't working, they'll sometimes be used. Okay? Just as an example. Now, another mechanism is that of reuptake. That is, it's a recycling system. And so the very same neuron that had the vesicles that migrated and dumped the neurotransmitter into the cleft also then takes it back up again, reuptakes it, if you will. If that's a verb, but it engages in reuptake. And as it sucks it back in, then it recycles it and it goes back in and works again. So, and there are receptors here that regulate the rates of reuptake, and there are drugs that can block reuptake or at least inhibit reuptake. Things like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors would selectively inhibit the reuptake of serotonin. Tricyclics also inhibit some serotonin and some norepinephrine, for example. So once you understand this basic mechanism, if you're pharmacologically inclined, you can think about all kinds of different ways to mess with the system and cause psychological changes, hopefully for the better. And so pharmacologists are always working on things that block receptors, that mimic receptors, that eat up the neurotransmitters, that block reuptake, and they're working hard on doing drug development that works on all of these different kinds of sites. But getting back to our purposes then, what we're really interested in is the extent to which there are changes in this postsynaptic cell that cause depolarization or hyperpolarization, and we're interested in that replicated across hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of neurons simultaneously so that it generates a large enough field synchronously that we can record it at the surface for the EEG. Oops, not that again, no. Okay, so and that's the concept of functional synaptic units, that there have to be enough of these individual neurons functionally linked together, that they function simultaneously and synchronously to create signals that then we can record at the surface. That was Neurophysio 101. People have questions?
Do
just to bring it back to the idea of an electrical circuit, now imagine if you were able to go inside an electrode and outside an electrode with your volt ohmmeter, or some more sophisticated version of it, then you could record action potentials as they occurred, because there would be changes in voltage that you would see. You could also record postsynaptic potentials, because again, there would be changes in voltage that you could see, depending on exactly where your probe was. Mm-hmm.
Can you maybe clarify on the difference between temporal and spatial formation?
Sure. Okay. So, at the moment that the neurotransmitter binds, there's going to be a quick change in the potential inside the postsynaptic neuron. And let's say it's excitatory, so there'll be depolarization, making it more likely to fire. That has a time course, actually. And that time course is such that if nothing else happens and it doesn't reach threshold, it goes back down. Okay? But if quickly in time again, there's another input, and it's also excitatory, then those two will sum, because this has not returned to baseline, and now the new change has augmented it further. It's depolarized it further. Now, if you can imagine this happening lots and lots of times, there might be enough of these coming in fairly close succession that before any one of them can fully return, the net result is that they sum to exceed the threshold and there's a firing. Now, spatial is similar, except they're coming from multiple inputs. That either input alone wouldn't be enough to cause depolarization, but coming from two separate sources, in this case A here and B here, then they sum to create something that's greater than either alone. And what really happens is, of course, spatial and temporal summation, and these were all excitatory examples, but excitatory and inhibitory. So in the end, it's you know, kind of a little battle that all the excitatory and inhibitory inputs coming in, some of them simultaneous, which would allow for spatial summation, and some of them lagged by a little bit in time that allows for temporal summation. And the net result is it does or it doesn't exceed that threshold.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So why does brain signal, like an ERP, flip whether you're inside or outside the school?
It actually flips at the point that you're inside or outside the cell, but not the skull. Now, it will flip depending on what you use as a reference. So if we were to imagine, that, okay, that'd be, that's too big. Okay, so that you might recognize as something. And inside the brain, I'll just say that we have an AC signal generator. And that AC signal generator is lots of EPSPs and IPSPs acting synchronously, a functional synaptic unit. And the net result might be that if, so we're now outside the cell, we're in a region, is that there's a general positivity here and a negativity here, let's say. So if I put my volt-ohm probe right here and right here, then this will look positive with respect to this. But I could also see it flip if I were recording, say, my active lead were, this is probably a bad reference, let's say for some reason this were my reference lead and this were my active lead, this would look more negative than that. So you can see a flipping of potential just by moving those around. But with respect to the cell, what happens here is now the inside is negative with respect to the outside. And so here's one probe and here's your reference lead. So those two are being compared to each other. And so the inside is negative with respect to the outside. And as the sodium goes in, there's an increase in positivity with the cell, but there's a net negativity right here. So right as I move this probe and I come back out and cross here, then what was seen as positivity on the inside is negative on the outside and vice versa. So that's the key point where they flip. And what you'll see is both action potentials and postsynaptic potentials in that region. And from our purposes, recording polarity is in some ways arbitrary, but we tend to assign significance to it based on common procedures. So when I was giving examples last week of the P300, it doesn't matter if it's P or N, as long as we always do it the same. And so given the kinds of references we usually use, which are inferior down here maybe by the mastoids, and we record superior up here on the scalp, then we'll tend to see positivities relative to those mastoids. So really, the only thing that really matters is positivity with respect to inside or outside the cell that's generating everything, and we don't see that when we're recording at the surface. Other questions? Okay, so I think we'll call it a night, and we'll start with a quick review of neuroanatomy next time before launching into the skin conducting system.